Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to 10% Happier early and ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. This is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. All right, we're going into the deep end today, kids, with one of my favorite repeat guests and a person I consider to be both a friend and a role model, Sam Harris. Sam is an author, neuroscientist, and philosopher. He's the author of many best-selling books, the host of a massive podcast called Making Sense, and the creator of a meditation app called Waking Up, which is truly an incredible resource. He's done a great job with that app. As I've mentioned before, Sam was a huge part of my own meditation career. He encouraged me early on when I was still skeptical about the practice. In fact, he got me into my first retreat and personally introduced me to Joseph Goldstein, the meditation teacher who's become a gigantic figure in my life. I have a co-interviewer for this episode. This marks the inaugural appearance on the show of a guy named Matt Harris. So we have three Harrises on the show. Although Sam and I share a last name, we are not related. Matt and I, however, are very closely related. He's my younger brother. Despite the fact, or maybe because of the fact, that I have been meditating for 14 years roughly, and despite the fact that Matt has been one of my closest advisors on my various books and meditation-related projects, I don't know if this is despite the fact or because of the aforementioned. Either way, he's never really gotten into the practice. However, that changed about a year ago when he quite suddenly got deeply interested. And one of the people he's really latched onto in his own contemplative odyssey is Sam. So I thought it would be fun to have Matt join us for this conversation. Heads up, we have basically the same voice, although he does tend to say smarter stuff than I do. So that's maybe how you can tell us apart. We cover a lot of ground here, including the psychological benefits of quitting Twitter, Vipassana meditation versus Dzogchen, which is a Tibetan flavor of meditation, a practice called looking for the looker, and whether Sam is in any way open to the metaphysics of meditation. In other words, what does he think about the notion that meditation can give you psychic powers? As they say at Amica, empathy is our best policy. Whether you need auto, home, or life insurance, they're ready to help you protect the things that matter most to you. They're a mutual company, customer-owned, in service to you. Amica representatives are here when you need them, and you can take comfort knowing a real person will be there on the phone to take care of you, because the greatest measure of their success is your satisfaction. You can count on T-Mobile to help keep you connected. After investing billions to light up their network from big cities to small towns, T-Mobile is America's largest 5G network. Plus, when you switch to T-Mobile, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus Verizon and AT&T. Visit your neighborhood store or T-Mobile.com to switch. Plan savings with T-Mobile, third line free on essentials via monthly bill credits versus comparable available plans. Plan features may vary. Credits stop if you cancel or change plans. Audible lets you enjoy all your audio entertainment in one app. You will always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. They offer an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers and new releases to celebrity memoirs, mysteries and thrillers, motivation, wellness, business, and more. The book I've been checking out recently is called Our Share of Night. It's technically, I guess, a horror, but it's definitely literature. I mean, it's incredibly well written, absolutely fascinating. And it really does rhyme with some of the themes that we explore on this show. I highly recommend it, although I'm only through the first 15-20% of it, but already I highly recommend it. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/10%. Or text 10% to 500-500. That's audible.com/10%. Or text 10% to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. audible.com/10%.
Dan Harris, nice to see you. And Brother Harris.
Indeed.
Yes, meet Matt Harris. Be prepared for confusion because he has the exact same voice as I do.
It's a little trick we play.
Nice. That could come in handy in high school, no doubt.
Well, some stories are coming to mind, but I will hold those.
For another podcast.
Yes, exactly.
Not very mindful.
Not back then. I do want to say that Matt is here because he's a huge fan of yours. He got into meditation pretty recently, even though his brother is co-founder of a meditation app, he's using yours. So that should say a lot about our relationship.
I've had analogous experiences. I've just given in. I just recommend your book as the book people should read first. So I'm no longer affronted by this at all. This is I engineer this. So yeah, I understand.
Matt and I spoke last night. He has a bunch of excellent questions. I'm going to let him jump in a second. But let me just start with some warm-up questions. You went off Twitter a while ago. Well, I guess it's X now. And I'm just curious, because I haven't spoken to you since then, not on the show since then. And I'm curious, what impact has it had on your mental health?
Well, it's been enormous. It's really, I think when I've talked about this on my own podcast, I've said that I'm embarrassed at how big an impact it's had, because it shows me just how deranged I had become, and I was just unaware of it. I think it's objectively embarrassing to say. It's one of the most important things I've done in the last decade to improve my life personally. I mean, it's just unbelievable. It's like getting out of a bad relationship. I don't know what to compare it to in my life. I guess I should just caveat this by saying that I don't think my experience on Twitter was so representative of the general experience, you know, because not everyone on Twitter, or certainly not most people on Twitter, have as public a platform as I had. I think I had 1.5 million followers at that point. And many people who have lots of followers don't have the same kind of controversial career that I have. I mean, they don't touch the same kinds of polarizing topics. So, and then many people who touch the same kinds of polarizing topics tend to touch them just from one side of the political spectrum or the other, right? So they have at their back a tribe of people who agree with them about everything, who will rush to their defense when they get mobbed. Whereas I'm very much in the center, and I've offended both sides of the political spectrum, because I've gone after the left and I've gone after the right more or less equivalently, or, you know, with equal frequency. So I had a very unique vantage point to just see just how dysfunctional and toxic Twitter could become. And so it got to a point where I felt like it was just subtly making me a misanthrope. Right. It was contaminating my view of other people in a way that I actually felt was inaccurate. It's not that I felt I was seeing just how bad people are. In fact, I was seeing a kind of funhouse mirror distortion. I was by no means the most avid Twitter user. I mean, I was somebody who would tweet maybe three times a week. Right. I think that was more or less my average, something like that. But I would check it a dozen times a day, 50 times a day, you know, even more depending, because it was my newsfeed, and I was just, that's how I was seeing things. So it was constantly punctuating my life. It was a kind of, you know, freakish meditation, and it became a meditation on my own, inevitably on my own digital reputation, and a kind of digital doppelganger that was a very powerful distortion of who I am. I mean, I was constantly reminded of the fact that millions of people think I'm a monster of some sort. And depending on whether they were coming from the left or the right, it was a very different monster, you know, vilifying me on that basis. And I was beginning to, as much as I tried to correct for the distortion I knew was coming into my thinking there, I just felt I couldn't actually correct for it in the end. I felt like there were many more psychopaths in the world than there are in fact, right? And so it was just a bad dream. And then the only thing I could do was wake up from it. And the only way to really wake up from it in a way that was durable was just to delete my account. And so it's been a huge life hack to get rid of it.
Now that you've done that, I'm curious, what would you say is the biggest challenge in your life and meditation practice or at the nexus of the two?
I mean, honestly, almost nothing. I mean, I can honestly say to you that the worst things that have happened in my life in the last decade, and this is a measure of just what a wonderful life I in fact have, apart from, you know, a couple of, you know, health scares and challenges, you know, for people in my family, it's all been Twitter. It's just every bad thing has been the result of something that happened on Twitter, something I felt I had to react to on Twitter, the consequences of having reacted to it. So it's unbelievable what a bad influence it was in my life and how slow I was to recognize its actual effects because, again, there's so much obvious good. One, it seems like a professional necessity for so many people, certainly people in media, journalists, academics. I mean, people feel like that's the only way they can stay in touch with what's going on in the world and the only way they can kind of market their own wares. And also, I was just following many, many smart, entertaining people. And so it just seemed like the dopaminergic effects of just seeing all the good stuff on a daily, hourly, moment-by-moment basis, it kept me blind to the fact that this was a psychological experiment that I got enrolled in and I never really read the consent form. And the results were bad. And I'm convinced the results are bad for almost everybody. I mean, I've got nothing to tell you that is a current challenge apart from the ordinary inertia of just gratifying one's interests and curiosities and desires and getting lulled into living a superficially very, very happy life and not really connecting with all the depth that is available because of just the mechanics of ordinary distraction. Right. It's just like the difference between really sinking into the well of being moment to moment in a starkly contemplative way and just having, you know, fun and reading good books and talking to good people and enjoying life. And insofar as there's a delta between those two modes of being, and, you know, it's easy to get kind of lulled back into a very pleasant kind of dream life. And so that's the challenge, but that's quite a privileged challenge at the moment.
Yeah, well, high-class problem, but still an interesting challenge. And I think hearing you talk about it would be educational, instructive for people. What can you unpack that? The difference between, on the one level, the superficial pleasures of life, talking to interesting people, having flavors appear on your tongue, et cetera, reading good books, interacting with ideas. And I can't remember the phrase you used, sinking into the well of being. Something along those lines. What do you mean by that? And how do you access it? And how do you remember to wake up from the dream to access the well of being?
Well, so as many people will know who are interested in meditation, the whatever practice you're doing and however you conceive of the goal of meditation, there's this distinction between being distracted and undistracted, between being identified with thought, lost in thought, captivated by thought, having one's sense of being in the world really, really trimmed down moment to moment by this conversation we're having with ourselves and the imagery of past and future that causes us to overlook the kind of the salience of the present moment. There's a difference between that and clearly recognizing what the mind is like in the present. Now, again, depending on what practice one does and how successful that practice has been and what kinds of concepts one has been taught to use to think about the goal there, that we could have differences of opinion about what there is to discover about the nature of mind in the present. But whatever practice you're doing, there's this difference between distraction and non-distraction. And yeah, so sinking into the well of being is just a, you know, somewhat verbose way of saying that there's, you know, prior to identification with thought in the present moment, there is a profundity to just being aware, just being identical to experience, whatever its character, right? Like nothing has to change about experience for you to recognize that it is already free of self, that it is already undefined. there's nothing to cling to, and no place from which you would cling, right? So that they you know, to use Buddhist concepts, you know, emptiness is recognizable in the midst of any experience, right? So it can be totally mundane. You could be in the middle of checking your email. You cannot have any, you know, prior moments of, you know, momentum in mindfulness to rely on. You could have been distracted for the last, you know, 10 minutes, but it's possible to locate even in this next ordinary moment that there is no center to experience. And there's just, you know, being is not an especially popular term among Buddhists to describe what's left there, but it captures some of the kind of positive quality of awareness without a sense of self, I would say.
Matt, maybe this is a good time for you to jump in because he's kind of led us up to one of the areas where I know you have some questions.
Sure. Sam, this is an interesting jumping off point for a question I had, and this is...
I'm smiling because the voice really is quite similar. It's hilarious. That's great. You guys could punk me right now.
He says smarter shit with the same voice, just to be clear.
I may say smarter shit with the same voice, but my brother has monetized it a lot better than I have in a direct way. So, but here we are. Sam, the question of what there looks like, which is to say this recognition that there's no self, I think is pretty consistent as a user of your app. But the path there, you know, as a not just somebody who follows your guided meditations, but somebody who's listen to a lot, maybe not most of the content, but a lot of the content, it can leave you wondering how you actually feel about the Vipassana path, you know, where you mm-hmm. really do all the work over years and years versus what you describe as this really attractive, more direct path that you've obviously found through Dzogchen. And yet, as I go back to the guided meditations, they seem mainly Vipassana. It's sort of the sort of mm-hmm. thing you would get in a regular way retreat or most of the content on 10% Happier, which, of course, Dan, I've also comprehensively listened to. So I guess I'd love for you to talk about, like, do you struggle with one versus the other? Not that struggle is a big feature of your life, obviously, but like, what do you actually practice mainly, and how do you think about those two traditions?
And before you answer, Sam, can you, in the process of your answer, define Vipassana and Dzogchen for folks who are new?
Yeah. So Vipassana is the practice in Theravada Buddhism, the oldest form of Buddhism. Vipassana is the Pali term that's usually translated as insight. It could also be translated as clear seeing. And it is the practice that has given us this just immense, you know, secular interest in mindfulness, right? Mindfulness is the state of mind one is cultivating in the practice of Vipassana, among other qualities of mind. Mindfulness really is the central tool. And this practice has analogs elsewhere in Buddhism, but, you know, Vipassana, as it is taught by our friends like Joseph Goldstein and anyone else who would teach at IMS or Spirit Rock, I mean, this is Theravada Vipassana. And the main export from that tradition has been mindfulness to the secular world and then the scientific community. Dzogchen is a strand of teaching within Vajrayana Buddhism, Tibetan Buddhism, that teaches what's often described as a non-dual approach to meditation. And there are other similar teachings within Tibetan Buddhism. Mahamudra is importantly similar to Dzogchen. And there are other non-dual teachings elsewhere in the Indian tradition. You know, Advaita Vedanta is the non-duality that one can find in the far more baroque and confusing tradition of Hinduism. But the interesting distinction between Vipassana and ordinary dualistic mindfulness and any non-dual teaching, you know, Dzogchen included, is that you can start from wherever you are, right? You can be someone who doesn't know anything about meditation and you're given a technique, and it's rather common to give the technique of paying attention to the breath, right? So we start by becoming mindful of the sensations of breathing. Every time the mind wanders into thought, we're told to come back to the raw sensation of breathing. And in that training of just noticing distraction and coming back to raw sensation, one is learning to practice mindfulness and one is gaining insight, vipassana, to what are described as the three characteristics of all phenomena in Buddhism, which are impermanence primarily and unsatisfactoriness and selflessness. And I would argue that in vipassana and virtually wherever it's taught, the primary characteristic one is noticing is impermanence, right? The unsatisfactoriness and the selflessness of phenomena, which are, again, these are billed as kind of equal status characteristics, but the insight into selflessness, the insight into unsatisfactoriness is virtually always taught as and experienced, I would say, as derivative of an insight into impermanence. It's because everything is impermanent, because there's nothing you can find that is durable moment to moment, that you can then extrapolate to the illusoriness of a durable self moment to moment. There can be no self of the sort that you thought you had if everything, every moment of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, touching, thinking, and even the consciousness that is knowing those things is passing away in the next moment, right? Changing, ceaselessly changing and ceaselessly passing away as you pay close attention. And there can be no desire so successfully gratified, no pleasant experience so wonderful that you can cling to that could represent a durable basis for happiness because nothing lasts, right? If something wasn't there a moment ago, the mere fact that it has appeared proves that it will be disappearing eventually, especially the stronger your concentration and mindfulness grows, you begin to see the truly punctate and, you know, piecemeal character to every experience. So the immense strength of vipassana and the dualistic mindfulness is that anyone can come through the front door and begin practicing it from wherever they are. They can be handed a technique and they can just begin walking the path. And I did that for a long time. And I think I'd probably spent about a year on silent retreat in increments ranging from, you know, a weekend to 3 months long, practicing that style of vipassana before I encountered non-dual teaching directly. I mean, I'd encountered non-dual teachings in books from the very beginning, and all that non-dual talk was a kind of advertisement for an alternate framing for the spiritual path. But it wasn't until that I actually got actual instruction from some great Dzogchen teachers and Advaita teachers that I actually was able to practice differently. The difference with what I would call non-dual mindfulness is that you actually have to have a specific insight in order to practice it. You can't actually do the thing with your attention that you need to do to constitute a moment of practice until you've recognized something about the nature of consciousness. It's a paradoxical teaching in that it's hard to tell someone how to start. You know, it's like, it's a little bit like an old Dharma joke. I don't know where it came from, but there's this, I'll move it to New York. You know, you're in New York and you're a tourist and you want to find Central Park and you stop someone on the street and you say, excuse me, can you tell me how to get to Central Park? And the person says, oh, I'm sorry, you can't get to Central Park from here. Right? I mean, that, like the paradox of that, like how is it that you could possibly be someplace from which some other place can't be reached? Right? It makes no sense. And yet that is in fact true contemplatively, meditatively, with respect to this shift between duality and non-duality. There's a spurious assumption of a starting point that has to be penetrated. There's something that has to be undone in order for you to actually start, right? That, like, it's not that you're, and we can talk more about this. I realize this is all sounding pretty cryptic, but to speak more directly about the experience, when you're given the instruction to be mindful in the beginning from a dualistic point of view, the way that happens for people is that they're told, okay, there's something that they should pay attention to sensation, to sounds, to the breath, to whatever it is, to emotions, to thoughts even ultimately, and just notice that everything arises and passes away. And inevitably you begin doing that feeling that you are a subject of experience. You're a kind of spotlight of attention that can aim attention strategically at the breath or at sounds. And so there's this subject-object dualism built into the very project from the beginning, where you feel like, okay, I'm over here paying attention. You might notice that you're being buffeted by thought that's inviting distraction moment to moment. But, you know, you're noticing that, and then you're coming back to the object. Let's say it's sounds or sensations of in the body. You're up here in your head as a subject, aiming the spotlight of attention, hoping to do this successfully and doing it successfully, noticing just, you know, the warmth or tingling or movement or pressure in the body, say, and having that kind of clear contact. But there is still this feeling of a subject, of a meditator, of a center from which attention can be paid to phenomena. And that is actually a false point of view. I mean, that's the starting point that has to be unraveled in order to start the non-dual practice of Dzogchen or any other non-dual practice. So when you ask me whether I struggle with the difference between Vipassana and Dzogchen, I don't struggle with it personally, but I struggle with it pedagogically, because it's a challenge to figure out how to get people to, you know, up to the threshold of this thing so that they can recognize what is already true of the nature of their minds. And for that, I think there really is no better preliminary practice than Vipassana. And I think Vipassana, you know, Theravada style Vipassana is actually, in my experience, and admittedly, my experience of the alternative is somewhat limited, but in my experience, I think it's much better than what is actually given in the Vajrayana tradition as the preliminary practice to Dzogchen, which is, you know, a lot of, you know, traditional Tibetan practices that, to my eye, don't actually prepare you as well as the kind of the rigorous Mahasi Sayadaw style mindfulness that, you know, I learned at IMS and elsewhere.
Coming up, Sam talks about whether non-duality can be reconciled with loving kindness and whether he's open to the notion that meditation can give you superpowers. The weather is getting warmer. Time to ditch my jackets and sweaters for shorts and tees. I used to waste my money on clothing that would only last one season. That was until I found Quince. Now I've got high-quality pieces that never go out of style that I will be wearing year after year. Quince has all the seasonal must-haves like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow-knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. I just made a big order at Quince.com. I got two pairs of sweatpants that I've just had for like a week, and I already love them. I'm wearing them all the time. Sweatpants are a huge deal to me because I work from home and I want to look reasonably good, you know, in front of my wife and stuff, but I want to be comfortable, and the Quince sweatpants do the trick. For me, the bottom line is they've got good looking stuff at low prices. Not a bad recipe. You should go ahead and upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/happier for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/happier to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/happier.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/happier. Just go to Indeed.com/happier right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/happier. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
It's Mental Health Awareness Month, and while meditation is good for your mental health. It can also be challenging. The 10% Happier app makes starting meditation easy. Download the app for free wherever you get your apps.
One of my favorite styles of meditation that both of you guys have taught me is metta, you know, compassion style meditation. Mm-hmm. But I will say it seems to have the potentially problematic aspect of reinforcing the subject-object divide quite definitively. Mm-hmm. Because there's sort of a you and then there's a set of thems. Every time I think about it, I think, boy, if Sam's trying to go somewhere non-dual, this is not helping particularly. Am I thinking about that wrong? Or is there a way to accommodate the meta tradition in a non-dual framework?
Well, there's definitely a way to do it in a non-dual framework because, again, there's already no center to experience, really. It's not like you have an ego and you successfully meditate that ego out of existence, right? The ego is itself an illusion even now, right? It's a false point of view. It's what it's like to be subtly identified with thought and not notice even the thought that you're now paying attention strategically as a meditator. What identification with thought actually is and why it occurs, I mean, it's an interesting question. I don't actually think I know what I think about that, but it's importantly analogous to falling asleep and dreaming. It is a kind of dreamscape, this sense of being identical to one's thoughts. It entails a similar degree of confusion about the status of one's mind in each present moment, right? So like when you're asleep and dreaming and you don't know you're dreaming, so leave lucid dreams aside, you really are just fundamentally confused about your circumstance, right? You're safely in bed, and yet you're having some experience that doesn't acknowledge that at all. And you could be very worried or you could be very excited or whatever is happening. But importantly, in the transition from sleep to dreaming, there's no successful reality testing, right? It's just amazing that we're not surprised when we suddenly, 5 minutes after falling asleep, we find ourselves walking down Madison Avenue or whatever it is. And there's no part of us, unless it's a lucid dream, there's no part of us that says, wait a minute, how the hell did I get here? And what's happening? Like, this is insane, right? And when, why are the laws of physics being suspended for me right now? If there's something similar that happens when we get captured by a thought in the present moment. I mean, where you're paying attention to the breath, you're supposed to be meditating. And then all of a sudden, you're thinking about lunch, or you're thinking about a conversation you had last night, and the transition into that and the feeling that that's you and the emotional consequences of it. I mean, if you're having a thought that is inspiring anger or anxiety, to suddenly become angry or anxious on the basis of this intrusion of language and imagery that came out of nowhere, right? It is kind of psychotic. It's completely normal. I mean, this is just the natural state for everybody, but it is quite similar to what we recognize to be the total delusion of dreams in the normal case of a person asleep, and also the clinical consequences of psychosis out in the world when people are awake. Unlike psychotics, we know enough to keep our mouths shut most of the time, so we're covertly talking to ourselves. But it is fairly crazy, and it's certainly crazy to have one's sense of one's own happiness entirely depend on this process that is happening all by itself. So again, very long answer to a short question. Anything is potentially compatible with non-dual awareness because non-dual awareness is actually the way awareness is if you just recognize it. So you can do metta, you can play sports, you can talk about the nature of the self, you can do anything because there's simply, in each moment, there is just consciousness and its contents. And the feeling of self is something that's being added, spuriously to this prior condition that's already, underwriting every type of experience.
And just tactically, the way you often are guiding people, in the app to focus on this reality is this concept of looking for the looker. And quite amusingly, you obviously get some feedback about that because now you commonly reference what to do when you get annoyed by Sam saying, look for the looker.
The most frustrating meditation instruction ever, apparently. So I get hate mail over looking for the looker.
You talk about being driven off of Twitter. I assume that it doesn't even come close to what you, disapprobation from looking for the looker. But and by the way, your advice to understand that feeling of frustration and then meditate on that. I've tried that with my wife and kids. That doesn't work for me. But if that approach to diffusing frustration works for you, God bless.
You cannot use it prescriptively when you've been an asshole. That doesn't work. It's no defense.
Yeah, my son recently was telling me he was bored, and I said, "How does that feel in your body?" And he said, "Is that a meditation thing? Because if it is, I don't want to hear it."
You should get used to that.
Exactly. Yeah. But Matt, let me just go back to your meta question, just for the uninitiated. Meta meditation is where you systematically, and Sam, I'm going to advance an answer or an attempt an answer here, and then maybe you can fact check me. But cool. Meta meditation is where you systematically envision beings, starting with an easy person, then yourself, then a neutral person, a mentor, difficult person, and then all beings, and you systematically love bomb them with phrases like, may you be happy, may you be safe, may you be healthy, may you live with ease. This is an ancient practice. And Matt's question was, well, is that compatible with the idea of seeing that the self is an illusion? And my answer to that is twofold. One, you got to think about mental exercise the way you do with physical exercise, that cross training is necessary. And metta meditation has benefits that include being a very good concentration practice. So it can really help you focus, and it can help you raise your baseline level of warmth, which for frosty New Englanders like you and me, Matt, can be very helpful. As it pertains to the potential confusion that could be created with this seeming concretization of the self, I suggest you maybe just ask yourself a question. Who is sending the metta? Who is sending the loving kindness? And just looking in that way gets you right to Sam's principal instruction. So Sam, I say that for your reaction.
Yeah, no, I agree with all of that. I mean, actually, you can think about it from two sides. One is that whatever your practice, even if it's a non-dual practice, you're going to spend much of your time, even most of your time, lost in thought anyway. Right. So why not be lost in thoughts of loving kindness for all sentient beings, right? And for yourself and for the people you love and for strangers and for even rivals and enemies. And you're going to be dualistically meditating on something inadvertently much of the time anyway. And if metta is something you're doing in that vein, it is, as Dan just said, changing the character of your mind. If you're going through the world thinking how much you wish people to be free from suffering, and you wish them, you know, you wish their hopes and dreams realized, and you know, thoughts of compassion and sympathetic joy are coming to mind, you know, when you see someone succeed, rather than, you know, fall into envious disgruntlement about that, you actually think that's precisely what you wish for them. Right. Like if you pretend to wish them Buddhahood, of course you also wish them a Pulitzer Prize, even if you don't have one. Right. Who are you kidding? Right. Like do you really think you wish people Buddhahood if you're going to be so miserly as to not wish them a Pulitzer Prize, you know, on the way to Buddhahood? So if you're continually undercutting your self-concern and the comparative judgments of well-being that people so effortlessly make, you know, you see someone succeed and you feel however subtly diminished by that. And as an antidote to that, you are dualistically thinking how much you want people to be happy and how much you're rooting for them to succeed. That is just a very different ethical foundation, you know, ethical and psychological foundation for one's relationships and encounters with people in the world. So it's just a good thing to do, whether or not it is something you would do if you could also just be non-dual moment to moment, right? But I would say that there's that way of thinking about it, which is even if it competes with non-duality, it's not a problem because you're going to be lost in thought most of the time anyway. But it doesn't actually compete with non-duality, because ultimately nothing does. You can just be aware of whatever you're aware of, thoughts included, without feeling identical to the next thought that arises, without clinging to experience, even the experience of knowing what is happening. I mean, being aware of experience. I mean, one way to think of identification is as a kind of clinging, right? Like there's a kind of clinging to the observer, you know, clinging to the feeling of being the witness of experience. Again, the words one uses here are really, all of them present various liabilities, but you know, the sanctioned words within Buddhism are words, terms like emptiness, right? And that's super confusing and requires a lot of explanation when you translate shunyata to emptiness and then have to tell people what that's all about. But what it suggests is what experience is like prior to concepts and prior to identification with any part of it, right? And it's to say that there's no self is also somehow to say too much or to be potentially misleading. You know, frankly, it sounds terrifying to people. Like, well, like, how could it possibly be a good thing not to have a self? And it seems somehow adjacent, if not identical, to madness, right? So how could the complete eradication of self be desirable, right? Again, the thing that you're experiencing from a non-dual point of view is not some new experience. It's kind of the prior condition of everything you were already experiencing. And there's less there rather than more there. Again, it's a little hard to describe, but the reason why it can often seem like there's a conflict between the two styles of practice is that dualistic mindfulness really can be practiced from the point of view of feeling that there's a real problem that has to be solved. And to feel that one's mindfulness in each moment is just revealing just the mediocrity of your identification with self and the impermanence of all experience, right? And it's not to say there aren't, you know, once you start getting any significant concentration there and any real continuity of mindfulness, then there are very pleasant mind states that appear, and you can be quite very expansive and drug-like, and you can feel like you're making progress. But the signature of progress inevitably there is this change in the character of your experience. Once things begin to feel meditative, it begins to feel a little drug-like. You begin to feel like, oh, okay, now I'm getting somewhere. It's starting to move. And that's just bullshit, right? It's like that is exactly what you don't want to be thinking and feeling with respect to the progress of insight. But it's just so easy to get stuck thinking you're schlepping up to the mountaintop and in every moment you're far from your goal and you're in danger of losing the progress you've made. Non-dual teachings impart the opposite message in every respect. The thing to be realized is already the case. Your awareness is already the mind of the Buddha. There's no difference between that in you which is aware of your experience and that which was in, you know, the historical Buddha's mind to be aware of his experience. And you're already identical to that condition. And you simply must realize it. And that doesn't have to take any time. Right. And there's nothing you're going to experience, however wonderful, that it really represents progress, because it's all transitory. It has no logical relationship really to this prior condition. This prior condition is already true. It's not improved by your feelings of bliss. It's not harmed by your feelings of restlessness and frustration. Restlessness and frustration are just as good as objects of consciousness by which to reveal this prior space. It's like the difference between, you know, this, like a pleasant sound and an unpleasant sound is just as good for the purpose of revealing the space in which sounds can be known, right? So there's nothing to hope for. There's nothing to regret. There's nothing to, like, it is a completely different framing. And yet the problem with this style of teaching is that the path is so steep. It's functionally a brick wall for many people. It's hard to figure out how to start. But the reality for most people is that they're going to spend most of their time distracted in the beginning. Like, there are very few people who recognize non-duality and then become Buddhas. So there is some reason to practice because the alternative is just to be distracted and to be pursuing all the other things you desire in life dualistically. And then, you know, in the ultimate case, you just sort of forget that you were ever interested in the Dharma, or it's like, that was interesting, but, you know, now I'm selling insurance and I've got all kinds of life anxieties, right? There are people who sort of fall off the path because all they had was this non-dual framing. So in my mind, Dzogchen has a very nice balance of recognizing kind of the paradoxical beginning, the always already true aspect to it, but then also recognizing just in an intellectually honest way that most people are going to need to do a fair amount of apparent work to stabilize this insight. And so in my view, what the practice then is non-dual mindfulness, right? So you're just practicing this thing, but you're not, it has none of the character that I described of, you know, the sort of the worst dualistic mindfulness, which is just this effortful slog up the mountain, really feeling like you're far away from your goal.
Coming up, Sam talks about why the consciousness we have is identical to the Buddha's consciousness, and as I keep teasing, whether meditation gives you superpowers. I love cats. I make no secret of that. We've got 4 cats. But here's the thing about felines. They poop a lot. You need kitty litter, and you need that kitty litter to do the job, which is why I'm proud to recommend Tidy Care Alert, which has long-lasting ammonia control. So your house or your apartment or your yurt or wherever you live does not smell like you have 4 cats or however many cats you happen to have. No judgment here. It's low dust and lightweight, which means no lugging heavy bags of cat litter up the stairs, and it's from the brand most often recommended and personally used by veterinarians. Tidy Care Alert uses color-changing crystals to detect potential concerns and help put your mind at ease. Let Tidy Care Alert help keep an eye on your cat's health. This show is brought to you by BetterHelp. I got to tell you, I feel so much better when I talk about my anxiety instead of keeping it bottled up. There's an expression that I first heard from the great researcher and also Zen practitioner Robert Waldinger: never worry alone. Our temptation many times is to keep it bottled up, but the data really show that the people who do the best in life, who live the longest and are the happiest, have strong relationships with people with whom they can talk about whatever's going on in their lives. And for me, therapy is part of that. If you're thinking of starting therapy, you might give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/happier today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/happier.
There's kind of a layman's version of this that I wrestle with, which is one of the concepts that you and people, you know, in my phase, which is to say early, think about a lot is the concept of attachment. You know, your life is filled with these attachments, and Vipassana meditation helps manage the level of attachment to these various things. And if you just think even physically about attachment, there's 2 things, right? There has to be 2 things in order for there to be an attachment between them. Mm. And so it's like the very purpose of doing it has this effect of stabilizing this, there's me and there's the thing I'm attached to and I'm managing to be less attached, but it leaves you very much still with the me. It's sort of inherently dualistic until you get to the point where then you're managing your own attachment to the concept of you, which is sort of, you know, in again, layman's terms, a little bit what you've been talking about. And it's just, I would say, a very big leap. Mm. After all this, you know, reification of the me through the management of attachment to then try to dispense with it.
Yeah, again, it's unfortunately, it is somewhat paradoxical. I don't know if you remember the story. It's at some point in waking up, I tell the story of the Asian tourist in I think it was Norway. Mm-hmm. Do you remember this story?
Yeah.
I don't want to bore people if you don't want to hear it. But for me, it's just, it's the best metaphor I ever came across for the kind of undercutting of the false premise here. It's this, this I think was real. I found this on the internet. This purported to be a real story of an Asian tourist in, I think it was Norway. It was on a tour bus, and the bus stopped at a rest stop and everyone got off to enjoy the view and have a meal. And the tourist, for whatever reason, changed her clothing at the rest stop, and then everyone got back on the bus. And at some point, someone stood up and said, "Oh, there's somebody missing. There was this Asian woman who hasn't gotten back on the bus." And because of language barriers and all the rest, the woman didn't recognize that what had been said there. And she thought there was a missing tourist along with everyone, you know, the other people on the bus. And they formed a search party and they went looking for the missing tourist, and she joined the search party. Yeah, and this went long into the night, and apparently, you know, helicopters were being readied for a dawn patrol to find the missing tourist. And at some point in the middle of the night, it was like, you know, 3 a.m, she recognized that everyone was looking for her, right? That she was the missing tourist. And if you just kind of reflect on the logic of that, what that epiphany was like and what it constituted, it did not constitute the fulfillment of the search, right? Like, it's not like the missing tourist was ever found, right? Or was ever missing, right? There was a premise that was false and that just evaporated. And something that was already the case was revealed, because there was no one was lost, right? Everyone was accounted for. Everyone was present. It was not like the stated problem was solved. The problem really did evaporate. And there's something about that kind of phase shift in a direction you didn't even know was a possible direction that does in some way capture the character of this insight, which is that, you know, the place from which you thought you were going to solve the problem was not the angle of attack was wrong, right? And it's inspecting it sufficiently revealed that it was, you know, palpably false, right? Like, again, I'm somewhat hamstrung by the words here, but there's something to reflect on in that analogy. It really does do some work for me.
Yeah, I agree. It does work for me as well. And I look forward to getting further on this. You said something in your description, which is, to paraphrase, that the consciousness that I have and that you have is identical to the consciousness that the Buddha had. And I think I know what you meant in a very secular way. You're saying, not that they are one and the same, but that they're identical but separate. But there is certainly a more religious or spiritual version of this line of thinking, which holds that they are kind of one and the same, that there's a unity or a sharedness to consciousness. And obviously you're kind of famously irreligious, so I wouldn't want to impute that to you, but even I, who also am quite secular, find as I spend more time on this that there's a temptation to be sympathetic to this view of connection, that this people use this idea there's a falseness to this separate self notion. And of course, they could mean within you create a false separate self from your own consciousness. But there's also, again, this lovely adjacent idea that, well, maybe I'm not even separate from everyone else, that we share some consciousness. Do you ever get kind of sympathetic to those spiritual notions? Or for you, it's, you know, if you can't prove it, it's just simply not a compelling idea?
Yeah, well, I'm very sympathetic to it, but from the other side, I mean, there's kind of a, what I would consider the false and quasi-religious and metaphysically aggressive approach to this would be, and this is the kind of thing that I think is the kind of message you get from somebody like Deepak Chopra. This is a callback to Dan. This is where we met at a debate with Deepak. It's the kind of thing that Deepak and I would disagree about. I mean, we might sound like we agree about a lot with respect to meditation and its importance and even its utility for bringing first-person experience into science. But here's what I think is the wrong way to think about it, which is we're these separate selves that feel separate from other people who also have their separate selves, and we feel separate from the world, from the environment, from nature, and from the cosmos. And that's an illusion. And if you meditate enough, you can discover that there's really just one big thing and you're it, right? You can just, you can get transported from your, you know, this separate vessel, and you can merge with the totality. And then you can recognize that you are the mind that gave rise to the cosmos, and you are the consciousness that preceded the Big Bang and all of that, right? And so it's this picture of fullness and merging. And in many cases, in many, you know, spiritual contexts, it's explicitly this notion that there really is a separate self. There's a soul. You know, you've got a soul, an eternal soul, very likely. And like a, you know, a water drop released from a rain cloud, it can merge with the ocean. And so there's that picture of merging. I don't think there's a basis, there's no scientific basis to speak in those terms. And I would say there's no contemplative basis to speak in those terms. Although I would admit that there are experiences you can have that seem to give credibility to that to some degree. I mean, like you can have experiences with in meditation or on psychedelics that do have a the character of being transported out. Like with respect to one's body and mind, there can be this feeling of going elsewhere. Whether you want to think about it as going elsewhere, you're like with respect, like merging with the cosmos, or you just want to think about it, the mind being much vaster than it normally seems to be, and it just opens up to something that's beyond the self and the body. Those experiences are there to be had, and they can seem to have metaphysical implications. I've always thought that we should be very slow to draw metaphysical implications from personal experience, no matter how profound and thrilling. I don't think you learn anything about cosmology through meditation. If you don't know anything about quantum mechanics before you become a Buddha, I don't think you're going to know anything about quantum mechanics after you become a Buddha. I see no evidence that the greatest meditators I've ever met knew much of anything about science by virtue of having spent 20 years in a cave or doing their other practices. So I just think these are separate domains. I mean, the truth is non-dual awareness doesn't even tell you that you have a brain, right? Much less that it's doing anything. Even that isn't obvious, right? It really doesn't tell you about cosmology or the births of stars or anything, right? But there is this conceptual insight, I mean, and also an experiential one, which, again, comes at, almost achieves the same thing from the other side, which is when you think about what makes us separate, what is it that makes me different from you guys? What's particular? But how is it that I wake up each morning and I experience my life and myself and my mind and not Matt's or Dan's, right? We all have the same last name. We should be pretty close to experiencing something similar. But I get the Sam version. You guys get Matt and Dan, and we never get confused. I never wake up feeling like I might be one of you guys. Everything that makes us particular as minds and bodies and as life streams, it's among the appearances in consciousness. It's not consciousness itself. There's something deeply impersonal about consciousness. To use the analogy of, you know, a film projector, right? It's like you could put new films in the projector, but consciousness really is just the light by which those films are broadcast on the screen. It doesn't have any intrinsic relationship to the particulars of experience, right? So that which is aware of joy is the same as that which is aware of anger or impatience or anything else. And that which is aware of your memory of your 12th birthday is the same as that which is aware of my memory of my 12th birthday. Because there's only one way for anything to appear by the light of consciousness. I'm sympathetic with the notion that consciousness is something like that, which is that there's no basis from which to differentiate that in you, which is noticing you at this moment, from that in me, which is noticing me. If you have a pain in your knee and I have a pain in my knee, there's no place in the universe other than where you are right now for that pain to be appearing, the pain that's in your knee. And so it is with the pain in my knee. It's very much like this coffee cup. It's like the space in the coffee cup is completely continuous with space everywhere. but there's no place for this coffee cup to express itself other than, you know, as it is here in this space, in the same space that is everywhere. So like, so consciousness is almost like subjective space. It's deeply impersonal, and there's no basis from its point of view to differentiate any point of view from any other point of view. It simply is the fact of having a point of view on the cosmos. So in that sense, when you're just recognizing consciousness as it is, it's not the same thing as merging and becoming a totality and getting access to more contents, right? It's recognizing your identity subjectively with the principle in the universe that allows for subjective contents. Consciousness is just the fact that it's like something to be what you are. So if it's like something to be you, and it was like something to be the Buddha 2,500 years ago, and it's like something to be my cat, there's some identity to that. But again, from a Buddhist side, you wouldn't want to reify it. You wouldn't want to emphasize its somethingness. It's just the fact that anything can appear subjectively at all.
So is there no aspect of Buddhism's metaphysical claims, for example, like rebirth, or, you know, much more controversially, the idea that you can get enough concentration and meditation to be able to manipulate the elements and have what are sometimes referred to as superpowers? I think I know where you stand on that. But is there no aspect of the metaphysical claims of Buddhism that you have some sympathy for after all these years of meditations, of meditation, or do you categorically reject anything that can't be objectively proven?
It's not clear what consciousness is. I mean, it's easy to be naively materialistic about all this, and I wouldn't want to do that. So it's very easy to think, okay, well, consciousness is arising in the brain, and we know that, and we know the brain's just made of meat. And so really, we're in a meat universe. You know, the universe is filled with meat and rocks and fire and forces like gravity. What we're talking about now, consciousness, experience, the feeling of being, anything that could be ascribed to the mind side of the mind-matter dichotomy, all of that is arising on the basis of the physics of things. And that may be true, except the moment-to-moment truth of our being in the cosmos is of being consciousness first, right? Consciousness is the only thing that can't be an illusion, in my view. And its dependence on the brain is quite plausible, but it's yet to be firmly established. If it reaches down deeper into the physics of things, I would not be especially surprised. I mean, I wouldn't quite know how to think about that, but it's totally possible. And all of us are in this very weird circumstance. We're all kind of in the matrix already, because all we have is, I mean, we impute a physical non-conscious world beyond our senses, but all we have direct contact with is consciousness and its contents in each moment. So we're all brains in vats already. I mean, we're already philosophical thought experiments. We don't have direct contact with the cosmos. We're inferring the cosmos on the basis of what we do have direct contact with, which is consciousness. So any, you know, deflationary reduction of consciousness to the physics of things can't be all that deflationary in the end, because consciousness is always first and foremost the thing that we're talking about, even if we're claiming to reduce it. And there's no evidence of consciousness anywhere apart from our direct encounter with consciousness itself, as consciousness itself. There's no evidence of consciousness in the world, in brains, in other animals, in other people, apart from the fact that we know consciousness directly in our own case, each of us. And then we extrapolate from that and say, okay, well, it's only parsimonious to think that other people are conscious too, right? And many animals are conscious too. And then we run into the conundrum of how far down to push that phylogenetically, you know. So, you know, is a cricket conscious? I don't know, right? At a certain point, your intuitions begin to get frustrated. But given how much we don't understand consciousness and its place in things, how astonished would I be to know that death is not what it seems, and something continues somehow after death? You know, like you wake up into something else this is a kind of simulation in some other simulation. I really wouldn't be surprised one way or the other. There's nothing I think I know about science or about the mind that would leave me astounded if death wasn't what it seems, i.e. the end of everything. Again, actually, this kind of connects with what we were just talking about. There's one section in Waking Up where I talk about an essay written by this philosopher, Tom Clark. Really, there's no substitute for reading his essay, but he argued, very much based on the impersonality of consciousness, that the birth of any conscious being, you know, after your death is in some sense deeply analogous to your own rebirth. That given your identity as consciousness, like your survival of death is more or less assured as long as consciousness persists anywhere. And I know that's not satisfying from the point of view of someone who feels like a self and who wants their self perpetuated. You know, like that's the only continuity that would matter. But when you actually get into the details of the argument, it's pretty interesting. I mean, it's not clear that what you imagine as continuity in your own case is really any different. Impossible continuity in your own case is really any different from anyone else's existing after you die. So anyway, I'll just leave that to the attention of anyone who wants to read it. But the philosopher's Tom Clark, and I'll give you the link. You could put it in the show notes. And as far as psychic powers, it's like my feeling, I'm totally open-minded on this topic. Like, I have, to the consternation and horror of atheists everywhere, I at one point said I was, you know, totally open-minded about psi phenomenon and, you know, whether telepathy is real, et cetera. But I'm also mindful of the fact that none of these things have been demonstrated in a lab, and they would be the easiest thing to demonstrate, right? I mean, that's the great scandal of our spiritual traditions, wherein people are rather sure that these powers are available. This would be the easiest thing in the world to demonstrate. You just could walk into, you know, Harvard Yard, and an hour later, you could have if you had these powers, you could demonstrate it to the satisfaction of scientists everywhere. And so the dodge in every spiritual tradition is that it would be somehow spiritually uncouth to demonstrate these powers, right? Like it's just, you know, it's just too crass. It's just not, this is not the way the saints and sages behave. Although strangely, they use their powers for far more trivial things in all kinds of other ways. I mean, like you hear the stories about Neem Karoli Baba or Deepa Ma or anyone whose students believe that their teacher had these powers. And it's just the most cavalier use of miracles. Like, I mean, I think there's one story of Deepa Ma where like they're all on a bus and, you know, there's some obstacle on the road, but they have to get to where they're going. So she like physically, you know, translocates the bus to some other room. I mean, it's just, you know, as preposterous as you can imagine. But yet, but for the purpose not of saving the lives of children or ending a war or doing anything else of great importance, it's just to get these people, you know, on their itinerary, you know, while traveling in India. Listen, if anyone has the power to really read minds or move objects without touching them, etc., you know, telekinesis, clairvoyance, telepathy, it would be profoundly compassionate to establish the reality of these powers and completely transform the worldview of Western scientists everywhere by having done so. In an afternoon, you could prove that there are more things in heaven and earth than are dreamt of in our philosophy, to the satisfaction of everyone. I could set it up. I mean, I could bring in the necessary skeptics. This experiment could be done. It would not be hard to do it. And it would be good for the world if these powers exist, right? So the fact that no one has done that, you know, it's the dog that didn't bark that should give us a lot of skepticism about the reality of any of these stories. And so that's where I am with it. I'm completely open-minded. I would fund the experiment. I would help run it. I'd get Darren Brown in there and every other magician who would backstop us against fraud. I would do it next week. So just show up, you great yogis who have the sufficient concentration. You've gone up and down the jhanas. You've trained these powers. Just come one, come all. I'll put you up in a Four Seasons in your desired city. And we will get to the ground truth of this. And the fact that you're not doing that, you yogis with jhanic powers, is not based on the impurity of the exercise, because it's, you could easily do this motivated by compassion for a, you know, a benighted humanity that does not know that karma is real or that all of these other things are worth paying attention to. You would prove that. The amount of faith in the project of meditation that would follow upon a demonstration of these powers and a press release from Harvard, Yale, Princeton, and Stanford that we now know this is real, a real capacity of the human mind, it would be a sea change. It would be all to the good, right? If you think that's not the case, you know, that I can be forgiven for believing that that's just a sign that you actually don't have the powers that everyone thinks you might have.
Well, that's a pretty good place to leave it. Let me just say that it is really fun to have two of my absolute favorite human beings on the planet together in this little digital room. So thank you both for making the time.
Nice. Well, happy to be here. And yeah.
Thanks for letting me crash the party.
Yeah. Nice to meet you, Matt.
Great to meet you, Samus, really. Thanks for indulging all my questions. I learned a lot. And thanks to, frankly, to you both for the work you've done, bringing this information to a lot of people who really need it. So this was awesome.
Nice. To be continued.
Thank you to Sam Harris and to Matt Harris. Fun to do that with both of those guys. Also, you heard Matt and I talking about Sam's incredibly impressive meditation app called Waking Up. And on that tip, we've got a special promo for 10% happier listeners. It's a 30-day free trial of Sam's app. All you have to do is head over to wakingup.com/10% to check it out. With over 50,000 five-star reviews, Waking Up combines the rigor of modern science and the power of ancient wisdom to help you live a better, more fulfilling life. Again, that's wakingup.com/10%. 10% Happier is produced by Justine Davey, Gabrielle Zuckerman, Lauren Smith, and Tara Anderson. DJ Kashmir is our senior producer. Marissa Schneiderman is our senior editor. Kevin O'Connell is our director of audio and post-production. And Kimmy Regler is our executive producer. Alicia Mackey leads our marketing. And Tony Magyar is our director of podcasts. Finally, Nick Thorburn of Islands wrote our theme. By the way, as I mentioned at the top of the show, Sam has been on this show before. If you want to check out his previous episodes, go to the show notes. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
For more than two centuries, the White House has been the stage for some of the most dramatic scenes in American history. Inspired by the hit podcast American History Tellers, Wondery and William Morrow present the new book, The Hidden History of the White House. Each chapter will bring you inside the fierce power struggles, the world-altering decisions, and shocking scandals that have shaped our nation. You'll be there when the very foundations of the White House are laid in 1792, and you'll watch as the British burn it down in 1814. Then you'll hear the intimate conversations between FDR and Winston Churchill as they make plans to defeat Nazi forces in 1941. And you'll be in the Situation Room when President Barack Obama approves the raid to bring down the most infamous terrorist in American history. Pre-order The Hidden History of the White House now in hardcover or digital editions wherever you get your books.
I'm Shimol Yai, and I have a new podcast called The Competition. Every year, 50 high school senior girls compete in a massive scholarship competition.
I wouldn't say I have an ego problem, but I'm extremely competitive.
All of the competitors are used to being the best and the brightest, and they're all vying for a huge cash prize.
This will probably be the most intense thing you've ever gone through in your life.
I remember that feeling because I was one of them. I lost. But now, I'm coming back as a judge and also a kind of teen girl anthropologist. Because if you want to understand what it's like to be a young woman in America today, the competition's not a bad place to start.
Hopefully, no one will die on stage tonight.
From Pineapple Street Studios and Wondery, this is The Competition. Follow The Competition on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to The Competition early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.